Welcome to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, we're talking about how Utah's delegation in Washington is reacting to the airstrikes in Syria, an indictment for a former Utah Transit Authority board member, plans to put a chain-link fence along 200 South, dividing the Rio Grande Shelter and the Gateway Mall. And environmentalists say that a long-term plan by Rocky Mountain Power violates federal law on coal-fired power plants. Those stories, plus your underplayed stories of the week and more. Joining me in studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Good morning.
Reporter Tom Harvey is here, too. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Reporter Emma Penrod also joins us. Welcome to you, Emma.
Thank you. Morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist George Pyle. Welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
You can join the conversation during this Friday morning news wrap-up as well by posting your comments and questions at sltrib.com or calling us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. A lot of news to cover today, but I thought we should begin at the international level. The U.S. launched cruise missile attacks on a Syrian airbase yesterday in response to the use of chemical weapons, apparently by the government there, the Assad government. Dan Harry, Salt Lake Tribune government editor, do we have a reaction from Utah's congressional delegation in D.C. yet?
We've heard from most of them. We still haven't heard from Mia Love and Rob Bishop, which is not unusual. They're sometimes not quick on the response. But Orrin Hatch, kind of gave it his blessing in a tweet and ended it with amen. Jason Chaffetz was very laudatory of it. He fully supported it, as did Chris Stewart. The only one that has expressed reluctance was Mike Lee. And his was, you know, as he often does cite the Constitution, says Congress should be authorizing action like this, an act of war.
Again, this is action in response to the use of chemical weapons of sarin gas, I think, apparently by Syrian forces, though the Assad government denies that. There were some choices in whether and how the U.S. might respond to this. I don't know. Maybe I can bring George Pyle on this, editorial columnist. George Pyle, what do you make of this particular response?
Well, it's kind of surprising because during the campaign, not getting involved in things like this, specifically not getting involved in Syria, speaking of tweets, were some of the things that Donald Trump had been tweeting about even before he was a presidential candidate. And his Make America Great Again, America First, I'm not the president of the world, I'm only the president of the United States, this inward-turning thing, which some people would see as isolationist, some people would see as patriotic, setting standards, setting priorities. So in a way, it's kind of a surprise that he would do this. On the other hand, there's been talk of all kinds of horrible atrocities in Syria, barrel bombs, and chemical weapons, which, you're just as dead either way. But still, the use of chemical weapons just frightens people. It's just it's horrible. People, you're just walking down the street, and then there's all this gas everywhere, and people go into convulsions and foam at the mouth. Well, and we'd heard about this for quite a while. This time we had pictures. This time we had video. It was on. People were posting it on Twitter, it was on YouTube. You couldn't avoid it. And it's maybe a little flip to say that this is what gets the president's attention is something that was on Fox News. But there have been accusations of this before. But you had this video shown all over the world, and I guess that meant that he felt he had to respond. Mm-hmm. Also, though, what Mike Lee is saying, and Mike Lee is Mr. Article 1, Congress should take back the power it has ceded to the executive over both parties over the decades. And this, I would tend to agree that this is not something that is as horrific as it was. There is no declaration of war. There is no authorization of force. I don't see how you could say that the original post 9/11 authorization to go after Al Qaeda and related things really covers this. So people are applauding. Yay, the president did something. We're not just sitting around allowing evil to take place. But we supposedly have some rules about this. And now what? He was supposedly palling up to Russia. Russia is on Assad's side. We thought, are we going to start accidentally killing a few Russians in Syria. And then what happens when we do that?
Well, and yeah, Dan, Harry, go ahead. I mean,
There were reports around this that the U.S. government actually notified Russia because there are Russian equipment and personnel and aircraft there, and they didn't want to accidentally take some of those out. So before the attack, before the missiles landed, they informed Russia, and supposedly they got out of the way.
Well, you would imagine also that Russia would have, being an ally of the
informed Assad, yeah, right. Absolutely.
So this comes at a period of time when the president has historically low approval ratings, and not just, I mean, for his own short tenure, sort of historically low from a historical perspective. And again, these ties to Russia are part of the turmoil that is infecting the president's administration. I don't know. It seems like a, I don't know how to explain this. Is this a convenient way? It's not a convenient way, but it seems like maybe that could be a calculus in a decision like this or not. He would say no, I'm sure.
Well, you know, you're talking about sort of a wag the dog scenario, I guess, and. You know, I mean, anything's possible, I guess. I don't think that I'm quite that cynical at viewing it this way. But, yeah. You know, it does bring the conversation back to something that Republicans and the president, I think, puts them in a good light, that they're decisive, that they are trying to strike a blow for, you know, humanity and kids. And so it does change the conversation that way. You know, let's hope that's not the motivation for it.
The beginning, potentially, of a bigger conflict, maybe?
Absolutely. You know, that's what we've found over and over again, is we get involved and we think, oh, this will be very limited. We can get in, we can get out, we can drop bombs, we can stay out, we don't have to commit ground troops. And, you know, that doesn't work out very well. Limited engagements in combat just don't work out that well.
Yeah, and also if you go back through history, you have, you know, Woodrow Wilson ran for re-election. He kept us out of war, and then we were in the war. Richard Nixon had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War, and he never really did. And now we have probably the most overtly isolationist president we've had in a long time, lobbing cruise missiles. And it just shows that, you know, you may come into office with this idea that you're not going to have a hair trigger and you're not going to escalate situations. And however many people die in the world, at least it won't be your fault. And then you get into office and you have all this power, and all you have to do is pick up the phone and say, General, open fire.
Yeah.
And I can see how that could go to anybody's head.
Well, isolationist as a candidate, at least this is a developing story, a kind of unsettling story. We're going to, I think, leave it there for the moment and turn to the local headlines from this past week. I'm sure that it's not the last of this story that we'll hear, though. A reminder to our listeners that you can join the conversation here by calling us at 801-355-TALK. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Let's turn to Tom Harvey and some news that has to do with the Utah Transit Authority this week. Kind of a follow-up on news from a couple of years ago, really. And the present-day part is a two-part story. Part of it is that federal prosecutors and the transit agency struck a deal of sorts, a kind of, I don't know if you would call it this, but an immunity agreement is what it looks like from the outside for UTA writ large, if not for individuals, board members. First off, can you sort of lay out the background here? Because UTA has been under scrutiny for the past few years. Why were they under scrutiny, and what's the background here, Tom?
Well, beginning, let's see, probably 2008, UTA started to develop. They were planning front-runner stations for the commuter rail. And around those stations, they started promoting and partnering, in some cases, with developers to create what's called transit-oriented development. So this would be, you know, apartments, retail, offices around a train station, the idea being that, you know, you're going to reduce dependence on automobiles, and they would have people who lived or worked there could take the train to work. And at the same time, you know, you would provide housing and retail space, and UTA hopefully would benefit as well economically.
There was an audit by the state legislature which found some fault. This is a couple of years back. A cozy relationship, a direct overlap, in fact, between developers and the UTA board. Is that right?
That's correct. There were actually two audits, one in 2010, one 2014, both of which found exactly what you're saying, a real too cozy relationship between members of the board, certain members of the board, I should say, and developers of some of those train stations.
The 2014 audit actually referred to them as sweetheart deals.
Hmm. Well, we're kind of burying the lead here a little because there's an indictment. But just before we turn to that aspect of the story, the deal struck between the feds and UTA, what does that entail, Tom Harvey?
Well, you're right. It was an immunity agreement. It's called a non-prosecution agreement, but it's the same thing, I think. And what it involved was the U.S. Attorney's Office here and U.S. Attorney John Huber reached an agreement with the agency itself that it would not be prosecuted, and in return for full cooperation in this ongoing investigation of the issues that we just talked about that were cropped up in the audits.
Did we know that that investigation was happening, the federal investigation of UTA? I mean, federal prosecutors investigating UTA. Was that something that we were aware of? I mean, we had the audit and we had other sort of signs pointing to that, but did we know that this was an investigation that was happening?
Yeah, I think the FBI has been investigating since 2012, and we've reported that okay. There was an investigation going on there. And we had information that a grand jury was actually meeting, too, and which proved to be correct.
So, okay. Yeah. Well, that gets us up to speed here. A former UTA board member, as we mentioned, has been indicted on a variety of charges. Are they related to the kinds of things that you just mentioned in the background that you gave, sweetheart deals, like Dan Harry said? And who is this? Tell us about this, actually.
Okay. The grand jury indicted Terry Deal. He's a prominent developer and also was on the UTA board for a number of years, I think about 10 years, actually, starting in 2001. I think he resigned in 2011. And so the grand jury indicted him on 12 charges. One of them is related to UTA. The others are related to his 2012 bankruptcy. And the one charge related to the UTA is that he got, I think the figure was, he had made around $1 million on, and it's not clear where that money came from, what the timing was of that, but then had failed to report that in his bankruptcy. So in bankruptcy court, you file for bankruptcy, and this is a Chapter 11 reorganization bankruptcy, and you're required to report what your assets are at that point, you know, where you spent your money, what your income is, and all of that. And so the particular charge is that he failed to report that money.
Okay, and that's on the UTA side of things. They're also indicting him for other similar charges, but not necessarily UTA related.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. It's the five charges of failing to report or underreporting certain income or assets, and then the others are concealment of funds.
A quick reminder to our listeners that you're invited to join this conversation. We're at 801-355-TALK, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Tom Harvey, getting back to the deal between prosecutors and UTA, it's an interesting announcement. It came just a day or two before the announcement of this indictment. Can we expect more announcements like that one, more indictments? And is it the same group that announced that deal that is indicting the deal?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're related, I guess, events, although the timing of it was pretty curious. Just one day after they announced the non-prosecution agreement with UTA, we get this indictment coming out publicly. And yeah, they say the investigation is ongoing and, you know, there's no promise of any more indictments, but certainly that would be the implication.
Are there clues in the legislature, in these audits, you know, the 2009 and 2014 or 2010 and 2014 audits that that might point us toward, I guess, what sort of bombshells, what sort of other shoe is about to drop?
Well, I have to say, I mean, one of the issues that it seems to me is raised by the indictment of Deal is that it's so not focused on UTA and those problems that came up in the audit. So the question is, and we haven't gotten a satisfactory answer to this yet, is are they bumping up against deadlines, you know,
statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here, because we're talking about conduct that it, with UTA that it would have happened in 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011. And so one of the statute of limitations could be a five-year barrier against charges. So that may be why we're seeing non-UTA-related charges in the Deal indictments.
Part of the impetus there. Dan Harry, go ahead.
And the documents they released on the first day when they announced this immunity deal did identify some of the issues. One of them was these executive bonuses that we've written about a lot over the years. They got up to $30,000 a piece for the top executives. UTA has now backed way off of that. But the deal making around the TODs, the transit oriented development that Tom talked about, is one of the deals. The impropriety of using like insider information to acquire property and then later on profit from it. Because remember, you're talking about public money here, that UTA is primarily funded with public money.
And is it, I mean, is that state tax money? Is it federal funding?
It's both. Yeah. The feds have poured huge amounts of money into this now network of trains, light rail and commuter rail that we've got. That's come at both state and federal, but the feds have poured tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars into this network.
And so in a nutshell, the sort of major complaint or worry here, I don't know, accusation, I guess, is that board members or people connected to UTA were buying up land in places where they knew a station might go and knew that the development would happen there and then profiting on that.
Yeah, it doesn't spell it out quite that clearly, but that's what it seems to indicate, yeah, that's part of what's going on.
Okay. You know, Tom Harvey, not that long ago on this show, you and I talked about, I'm just thinking about this, some testimony in a trial. This is the trial of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow, now acquitted. But one witness, a witness whose testimony was kind of effectively discredited during the trial, dragged the name of a former UTA board chairman into that case. And this is current Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes. Like I said, discredited testimony. But do those allegations, there were allegations about a meeting that took place in California. I mean, this is all sort of not, it wouldn't be admissible in court now that it's discredited or testimony that's come and gone, but having to do with developers meeting in California or UTA people meeting in California at this Pelican Hill resort. I don't know if listeners are going to remember what I'm talking about. Maybe you could bring us back up to speed.
Sure. So actually, at a hearing before and during the trial of former Attorney General John Swallow, there was a former developer, Mark Sessions Jensen, who brought up, I should say, in response to some questions, he brought up these allegations. And his allegation was that back in 2010, I think it was, there was Jensen was living down in this luxurious resort down in California called Pelican Hill, and that one day Mark Shurtleff, the then Attorney General, showed up with John Swallow and other people, and that one of those persons was Greg Hughes, the current Speaker of the House, and that there were other UTA officials here, the attorney for UTA, and he said that he was told that they had a meeting down there about with then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and it was about these UTA stations. Now, that you're right, that was not collaborated, and he seemed to wither somewhat under cross-examination during the trial on these things. But as far as I know, there's still yet no evidence to back those
up. And Hughes vehemently denied that he ever attended such a meeting.
Right, and there was, I mean, he even had calendar evidence showing that he was at a charity boxing event, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. But there, he does have a sort of longstanding partnership relationship in business with Terry Deal. Is that correct?
He does. And, you know, he says that he was not involved in the deals we're talking about here around the Front Runner station in Draper. He claims he got no money out of that. He's insisted that he received no money from it. We do know, because Greg Hughes volunteered this was that a week before this immunity agreement was announced with UTA, that he met with FBI and or federal authorities is what he said, and talked to them, gave them information. He said he did it voluntarily, and he said that his attorney was informed that he was not the target of an investigation.
George Pyle, editorial writer. And actually, first, let me go to Tom. Do we have any word from federal prosecutors on that? Is that that he's not the subject of an investigation, Greg Hughes?
No, that's strictly coming from his attorney at this point.
George Pyle, the Salt Lake Tribune wrote an editorial about the deal that that was struck between UTA and prosecutors. And I guess the question that I'll ask to get you rolling is, are we now in a more, you know, a new era, a more ethical era for UTA than we've seen in years past?
Well, yes, you could say that, but we've said that two or three times before, too, and these things keep rolling out. They change members of the board, they change chairmen, they change executive directors, and so they always say, well, it's a new day for UTA. And the board chairman said just this week that with the agreement with the feds that this dark cloud has been removed from the UTA, and our editorial was, well, not so fast. I mean, it may be parting, and we may be going into a brighter era right now. And the people who are running the agency now are different than the people who were running the agency then, at least at the top. But still, I mean, the governance of the UTA, like a lot of, you know, multi-county things, it's kind of its own beast. We don't vote for members of the UTA board. They are often appointed by people that we do vote for, mayors and county councils and things. But still, you know, whoever voted out a mayor or voted out a county or a city councilman based on something that happened at UTA. I mean, it's removed from the voters. Therefore, it's often removed from people's awareness unless they ride the bus and they're mad that the bus is late, but there aren't enough of them to swing an election. So it becomes a matter of them realizing that in order for them to do their job, in order for the trains to run on time, which is what the current board and executive director seem to be concerned about more than anything, they need money. The fares will never support this. They need taxpayers' money. It took them 2 years to get the legislature to agree to allow them to even put on the ballot a sales tax increase. They finally got that done. They finally got it on the ballot. It failed in Salt Lake County and in some other places, largely, I mean, partly because people just don't like paying more taxes, partly because people don't trust the UTA to make proper use of that money.
You know, just before we let the story go and go to a break, because we do have to go to a break, I want to go back to the story of Terry Deal for a moment, because one detail from that story blew my mind, which was, and I hadn't read it before, maybe some listeners out there had, but this has to do with what sounds like an insane night in Las Vegas. Tom Harvey, can you tell us about this? It was in his bankruptcy declaration, some massive amount of money that was blown in one night. Tell us about this.
Yeah. Dad, do you remember the total?
It was $450,000.
$450,000.
In one night that he acknowledged at the hearing for his bankruptcy that it was – he lost it in one night at the Aria and the MGM.
And the checks are actually in the bankruptcy records, and these are it appears to me, I don't know how this works, but it appears to me that MGM extended this money to him, and so that's why it's in bankruptcy court. It's a claim that he owes them this money still.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, who knows? I mean, part of a $42 million bankruptcy claim.
$47.5 million, he claimed he was in debt.
$420,000 might not seem like that much at a night in Vegas, apparently. Okay,
it's all relative, as they say.
Yeah, this is the story is interesting, the UTA story. It's a follow the money story, if ever there was one. Tom Harvey, thank you for talking to us about it this morning. We will turn to other stories, including the planned fence along 200 South, which, whether this is the intention or not, will serve as a barrier between the Gateway Mall and the Road Home homeless shelter. First, though, we've got to take a quick break. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, presenting Luke Saterna, the choral music of Moore and Lauritsen, featuring performances by Lauritsen, Saturday, April 15th at 7:30 p.m. in the Ellen Eccles Theater. Tickets at AmericanFestivalChorus.org.
I'm Carrie Bringhurst, News Director and Morning Edition host here at Utah Public Radio. Our Utah Public Radio news team serves as a statewide source with reporters in Logan, Moab, Southern Utah, Salt Lake City, and Provo. If you have comments, story ideas, or questions for any of us at the station, we'd love to hear from you. Visit our website, upr.org, share ideas on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Be sure to include hashtag IAmUPR. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, reporters Emma Penrod and Tom Harvey, and editorial writer George Pyle. You can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. We were just talking about a story involving the Utah Transit Authority, UTA, and before we turn to other stories, we do have a caller on the line who has a comment about UTA. This is Claire from Cottonwood Heights. Claire, hello and good morning.
Good morning. I have worked for years watchdogging UTA, and I've been extremely frustrated that we haven't been able to get much response upon Capitol Hill. And I think this is a time that we really need to look at the entire structure of UTA, because for some reason, when things have gone wrong, because it's split up, I guess you'd say that the oversight has been split up between so many different areas that no one area believes they can step in and do anything. And, you know, we pushed really hard to get those two audits out, and then nothing was done. And so I can't tell you how many times I've been up on Capitol Hill to talk to a legislative
committee,
and basically they do nothing. And
yeah, Claire, let me just pose this question to reporters here. The idea that that there's not effective oversight of UTA, and that even after an audit, nothing gets done. I mean, who is responsible for overseeing UTA and enacting changes?
That's the problem. And I think Claire, it's Claire Geddes. Hi, Claire. And she's right. She's been up to the Capitol Hill a lot on these matters, lobbying. And and there is no accountability because of this system you've got of this board that's appointed by all these different entities. It's not, however, just a problem with UTA. We've got a lot of these, they call them quasi-government entities, and they're the same way.
Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know. Not much of a solution there. It's just sort of
not much of a solution, although I would disagree with one thing that Claire said, and she said nothing came as a result of these audits. Well, a criminal investigation came out of one of these audits, or probably both of them.
And this is what we're talking about right now.
Right.
Okay. You know, we've got to turn to other stories from this past week, and so we'll leave it there. Claire, thank you very much for your call. And Dan Harry, I want to turn actually to the division that exists in city government over a fence that is being proposed along 200 South. Actually has a UTA tie-in, as a matter of fact. This is a vinyl fence whose purpose has been called into question. Lay this out for us. What is this?
This is a really interesting story, and it's kind of strikes close to the home at the Tribune, because we're officed at the Gateway.
Right.
And this fence will go up right outside the Gateway, between the Gateway and the homeless shelter, right down the middle of 2nd South. The plan is for a block-long, chain-link fence wrapped in vinyl. When we first heard that, we thought that's going to be, you know, not a see-through fence, but UTA assures us that it will be a see-through fence. Just vinyl will be wrapped around the chain link. I don't know why, to make it prettier. I don't know. But and they're going to close off the mid-block crosswalk there. And the city's behind this. The UTA is going to pay for most of it and is behind it. But it was originally lobbied for by Vestar, the new owners of the Gateway, which, you know, kind of shows you some motivation for it. UTA and the city both have denied that it's trying to keep homeless people out of the Gateway, that it's all about public safety, that they've had emergency braking of trains there that shows you there's a public safety problem with pedestrians crossing the street, and that, you know, it could lead to accidents. Well, we followed up and asked for the records, internal records of UTA's emergency braking incident reports, and found that there are five other stations that have worse public safety records. But none of these fences are going up in those places.
Well, and what you're hinting at here is that, and as some people are speculating, that the purpose of this fence is to separate the Gateway Mall from the Road Home Shelter. You know, you said this was brought to the city by Vestar, the the owners of Gateway. Mm-hmm. Were they bringing it to the city because of an expressed transit safety concern or safety for safety concern?
We don't know. The emails that were obtained by KUTV2 and then some more later by us don't really spell out the motives. They just show that Vestar wanted this project done. They kept following up with repeated emails. Where's the project now? When's it going to happen? You know, and so they don't really spell out that.
The city council, meanwhile, sent a letter this week to the mayor's office on this very issue. What did the council have to say?
Well, the council, this is a continuing battle between the council and the mayor that they felt like they were totally cut out of the loop here. This was a decision by the mayor that went along with lobbying and talking to UTA to install this. The city will pay a few thousand dollars for the crosswalk closure and some road striping issues. UTA is going to pay the bulk of it, which it looks like it's going to be around $40,000-$45,000 that UTA is going to lay out on this thing. Vestar is laying out nothing for the project. But the council felt that they were cut out of it, and they want a full briefing. They want to know more about these public safety statistics. And they want to feel like this is, you know, part of a like over city planning that the city's been pushing for mid-block crossings as part of being a walkable city and and a livable downtown. And this goes against that. So they want more answers.
And again, this is just a one-block fence in one very specific part of the city when, as the Tribune, through its open records requests, found out there were places that are more, I guess, have more incidents
that raise more safety questions. Right. And one of those, the worst is Gallivan Plaza on Main Street. And there were more than double the number of these emergency braking instances with trains there for pedestrians than there were at the old Greektown station. Can you imagine anyone proposing to put a 5-foot-tall chain link fence down the middle of Main Street? You'll never see that happen.
So I guess how does the mayor's office stick to the idea that this is about transit safety, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And so does UTA.
Okay. I'm thinking back to the deadline for the closure of the Road Home Shelter, the supposedly fixed deadline for the Road Home Shelter. I think that there's some debate as to whether or not that's going to happen. But if the Road Home closed down, would the fence come down? Would it stay there?
Yeah. There's indications in these emails that this is supposed to be designed as a temporary section through the crosswalk that it would be removable so that that crosswalk could be restored once the shelter's gone.
And I guess the population density they're expecting would change as a result of that closure. Although,
yeah,
I don't know, there are still service providers in that neighborhood, though. I'm thinking of St. Vincent de Paul's, the Weekend Center.
We don't know. You know, in other open records requests, we've received communications with the county and others that indicate that those other service providers may be gone as well. And there's not been a lot publicly said about this so far.
Mm. George Pyle, pedestrian fencing is not an unheard of concept in transit areas, but this is, again, just one block when there are others that may have some safety issues. What do you see here?
Well, I think it's obvious. I mean, the owners of the mall, it's getting kind of lonely over there. I mean, we have our offices over there. And every time you go out, you know, I'm just going to go out and take a walk, get a breath of fresh air. It seems like another storefront is empty. A few months ago, they started putting up guards and fences and stuff. And I don't know how open they were about this, but it was to keep the homeless people out. And before you knew it, the food court was empty in the morning and they all started closing. I mean, those homeless people, some of them had some money to buy an Egg McMuffin, and now McDonald's is gone after they chased them out. They're going to remodel all that, they say, and they're going to redo the whole thing, and they have all these grand plans. But, you know, we get word that the whole purchase of the mall by this company was based on some kind of assurance that, oh, don't worry, we're going to do something about this homeless thing. And they are working. I mean, you know, this is where the two big stories of the week, the issue of homelessness and the UTA. This is the Venn diagram where they cross each other. And I have been out there and I have seen people, you know, it's not a matter of, it's a little different from Gallivan where you have people who are running to catch a train and things. At the gateway, there are people who are obviously under the influence of a illegal substance who are kind of wandering out into the street. And so mm-hmm. even though there are more incidents other places, I can kind of see the reason you do it here is because you have a larger population of people who are really vulnerable.
I've got a preventative measure yeah. based on that population. You know, actually, sorry, Dan Harry, maybe I'll bring you in for one more second because George said something that I think is kind of interesting. He says that, you know, there's speculation, there's word out there that there was some kind of assurance to Vestar before the purchase of Gateway that something would be done about the homeless shelter. Is there evidence of that?
Well, yeah, I think there is, but I don't think there was a specific date put on it. I believe that, you know, the city leaders and others, told them, yes, we're working on this. We plan to do this scattered site, shelter site program. We're planning to beef up services. So, yes, we are planning that shelter not be in the area. But I don't think that it was a kind of a quid pro quo where if you buy the mall and promise to invest in it, we'll close it by such and such a date.
If you unbuild it, they will come.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm sure this isn't the end of the fence store. Actually, Dan, when is the one block fence going up?
We don't know.
Okay.
This was a done deal, according to the emails between the city and UTA and Vestar. But it looks like this concern that the city council now has stepped in and asked for more information and asked to be briefed and asked for some justifications. You know, it could be delayed for a while.
All right. Well, a story to follow up on. A reminder to our listeners that you're tuned to the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'd like to turn to a couple of stories from the Environment Desk next, both having to do with Rocky Mountain Power, the electricity monopoly here in Utah, and maybe, let's start with that, and we'll go to a break in a little bit. But Emma Penrod. Maybe we'll go chronologically here. One story has to do with a major expansion of the company's renewable energy generation capacity. Tell us about Rocky Mountain Power's plans to do that.
Yeah, well, in a way, they're kind of two stories stemming from the same issue. Earlier this week, Rocky Mountain Power filed its 20-year resource plan, which is supposed to file every other year or so to, you know, state regulators. And one of the things that was in that plan was the announcement of a new project that will build more than 400 new wind turbines in Wyoming to bring 1,100 megawatts of wind energy online for the whole Rocky Mountain Power system. It will be built in Wyoming, but Rocky Mountain Power is a company that operates in many states, and Utah is its largest customer base. So that power would more or less be coming here.
Mostly purchased here in Utah. So you said 1,100 megawatts. What does that mean in terms of the overall picture of how Rocky Mountain Power produces electricity? How many mm-hmm. Homes would that power, I guess?
Well, it would represent an increase of 10% to Rocky Mountain Power's current capacity. So that's sizable for one project.
And I understand that they're trying to do this while a federal tax credit remains in place that they can kind of capitalize on. Is that mm-hmm. part of their impetus for doing it now?
Yeah, they said that was their main motivation for doing this, at least right now. It sounds like they don't necessarily need the additional power right this moment, but they felt because of the tax credit situation, they could build these now and they would be available later on when they then need to, you know, actually use the power.
Okay, so an investment and an increase in renewable capacity, mm-hmm. which is something that you would think would be welcome news from the environmental community, for example. But the company is drawing fire for not doing enough, and this is because of an aspect of their 20-year strategic plan submitted for review to the Utah Public Service Commission on Tuesday of this week. What is it that environmentalists are upset about in this plan, Emma?
Yeah, well, it's the same plan.
Okay.
So what was also then indicated in this plan, and understand the purpose of this plan, what they do, is Rocky Mountain Power looks at the next 20 years and it says, based on the rate of growth in all of the areas we serve, we think we're going to need this much power, and here's how we plan to deliver it for the next 20 years. And they break it down, and we're going to build this plant, or we're going to have this solar activity over here, or we might have to shut down this plant because it's old and expensive, and we'll replace it with, you know, whatever. So that's kind of the planning process that goes on here.
Right.
And as they do this, they usually look at many different alternatives, and then they propose a preferred alternative is what it's called, or a preferred portfolio, because it's a portfolio of resources. Mm-hmm. And they present that to state regulators and say, we think this is the cheapest, best way to provide this power. Can we get your blessing on it? And the preferred portfolio that showed up in this latest plan did not include the installation of selective catalytic reduction, which is a form of pollution control that the EPA has required at two power plants in Utah.
These are coal-fired power plants.
Yes, these are coal-fired power plants.
Okay.
Those were required by a ruling on the Regional Haze Act.
And that's a fairly recent decision from the EPA on pollution controlling technology to sort of install. But Rocky Mountain Power has been suing litigating to prevent that from going into place. They're not including those plans, their long-term plans. I guess is that something that is the cheapest way for them to go, is to not do this, and that's why they're doing it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you have an option between doing something and not doing something, you're going to have to pay to install pay someone to install these you know, devices at their systems. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be cheaper not to do it. And that's basically what they did. They said, you know, look, we're involved in this lawsuit. And so what they did was they looked at how these lawsuits had played out all throughout the U.S., and then they looked at some of the settlements, the legal settlements that had resulted from some of these cases, and used those as various hypothetical outcomes as what could happen in their case. And then they picked the one that was the cheapest, which was one that had them not installing the pollution controls.
Do you know if do they have a speculated settlement price included in their 20-year strategic plan? Just out of curiosity, that's interesting.
Not that I saw. So it is a 300-page report. You know, haven't read it word for word, I'll be honest, just yet.
Environmental groups, including Heal Utah and the Sierra Club, are both saying this is violating the law, because as the law stands, as the decision from the EPA comes, they're supposed to abide by it. Rocky Mountain Power doesn't see it that way. Will the Public Service Commission get a say here?
Yes, this is all going to go before the Public Service Commission. They have a process for dealing with these kinds of disputes. Very new issue. It was just barely filed, so they haven't quite got around to this yet. But they will be, scheduling a hearing where interested parties can go and say, we don't like what we see here. We think this maybe needs to be refiled, needs to be revised. There will also be a public comment period where, you know, really anyone who's interested could, you know, send some thoughts over. And then the Public Service Commission can, you know, maybe request that this be revised before the end of the year.
That's a possibility.
If they don't like it.
I want to turn to George Pyle, editorial writer, a question over the letter of the law here, but there's also, of course, the ever-present issue of climate change and the role that carbon emissions play there. I don't know. What do you make of this?
Well, one of the things I think Rocky Mountain may be basing its plan on is the idea that we have a new administration now which thinks climate change is a Chinese hoax, and that they might reverse the Obama-era regulations. I mean, you have to jump through as many hoops to repeal a rule as you do to pass one, so that might take a while. And the issue also with the Public Service Commission, I don't know. I mean, does the Public Service Commission, are they supposed to count climate change, or are they just worried about the bill,
the
electric bill?
Yeah, the Public Service Commission, its job is to make sure that the utility isn't scamming customers.
Right.
They have to, you know, they will be concerned with, is this a fair price? Will it meet customers' needs? Is it doing so at a reasonable cost, or is the cost inflated? It's going to look at those things. It's not really going to look so much at the environmental aspect.
Yeah,
it's not part of its job.
Yeah, where they would look at it is if they say, well, look, the feds are going to make you spend this money, so you have to account for that in your budget.
Yes.
The Public Service Commission would do that. The Public Service Commission, as I understand it, is not set up to say, well, you have to factor in the costs of all the extra asthma attacks and all the missed days of school and work, and you have to factor in those costs. They don't do that. It's a regulated monopoly, so their job is to keep the lights on.
Direct costs.
Make sure that Rocky Mountain Power is making enough money to stay in business and keep the lights on, but not so much that they're gouging the customer. And this concern about whether we're destroying the planet in the meantime is really not on their list.
Well, and as you said, Scott Pruitt, EPA administrator, is a different administrator than Gina McCarthy was, former under the Obama administration, so changes may be afoot. We'll see what happens there. Guys, I'm sorry, we have to take another quick break. Still to come on the show in the final few minutes, a protest at the Salt Lake City International Airport over a scheduled deportation. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions has warned that he might crack down on states with legal marijuana, so there's only one thing to do. Plan your trip to Colorado now. Wait is heading to Denver this week, where we will talk to Governor John Hickenlooper about how the state plans to defend itself when the narcs descend. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for this week's Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Searching the web for what's on the next Radio Lab. As we interact more and more with machines, what are these relationships telling us about ourselves? It's nice of you to ask. I've wondered that myself. Of course it matters.
You are so special.
Send me your credit card info.
Here's the contact information.
Join us Saturday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Tom Harvey, Emma Penrod, and George Pyle. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions for the next 8 minutes or so by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, we'll just quickly run through this story as we have limited time, but on Thursday, several groups rallied at the Salt Lake City International Airport to try to have some sort of effect on the scheduled deportation of a local woman who was being sent back to her native Colombia, or was slated to be sent. Tell us about this.
So this group, primarily driven by the Mormon Women for Ethical Government, went to the airport and talked about this woman's story. And she's lived here for 20 years. She has a son that still lives here and a mother. But she originally came here legally, but overstayed a visa, as is the case in many of these undocumented cases. Right. And the authorities have known for many years that she's here, and she's been given, she's been allowed to stay for one reason or another. But suddenly, we don't know why she was informed that, get ready because you're being deported.
And some of the part of the reason that she was maybe being allowed to stay had to do with the fact that she was the sole caretaker for
her son and a mother,
and her,
I believe.
And one of them is disabled. Her mother is elderly. And now conceivably being sent home. We don't know exactly what has happened with her story yet.
Right. Her flight that was originally scheduled kept getting delayed and delayed. And the last delay, it was supposed to leave at 1:40 this morning, and I haven't seen an update to know whether that happened or not.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on it. Guys, this is the end of the program. We've got to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Dan Harry, I don't know if you want to keep going with that story or start with something else.
I'm going to just mention a story by Ben Wood about teachers in the Jordan School District. Their own union has proposed some salary increases, and the ones that are getting left out are the mid-career folks. And they're kind of wondering why our association is not paying attention to everyone that's teaching instead of just the beginning teachers and the veteran teachers.
Hmm. So people mid-career not getting raises. Emma Penrod, your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, so some people might know I'm a little bit of a music nerd in my spare time. And this weekend at the Utah Symphony, they're going to be playing Pictures at an Exhibition, which is a favorite of mine personally, I guess. And they're also going to be having a special guest of a historic French tuba that was actually one of the instruments that played at that piece's debut. So that's a fun story. That's also on our website. Check it out.
That's pretty cool. A tuba, a sort of journey through time. I like it. Emma Penrod. Tom Harvey, do you have an underplayed story of the week?
Yes, I've outsourced mine.
Okay.
And the pick is Mike Gorell's story that on Wednesday that about the disparity in pay between men and women. Utah is now the third, has the third biggest disparity in the country. Utah women earn 71 cents for every dollar a man makes.
Okay, biggest disparity for Tom Harvey's underplayed story of the week. And George Pyle, yours.
Well, I'm, like I say, if it's underplayed, I haven't heard about it. I'm going to, I want to plug my column that's in this Sunday. And for the story, that based on the Utah Supreme Court says that the state can ban Tesla Motors from selling direct to customers and not having a network of dealerships like everybody else has to. And, of course, the first thing a newspaper man thinks when the law protects a legacy business from the upstarts is, hey, where's the protection for newspapers? We provide an important service. We're job creators. Where is the law that protects us from these people coming along and eating out our sustenance by stealing our classified ads and publishing fake news and leaving us high and dry? Well, there isn't any such protection. There shouldn't be. You'd have First Amendment issues with picking winners and losers in news sites.
Right.
But when the car dealers or Rocky Mountain Power comes in and they say, we don't want to play by the new rules, we want to play by the old rules, we're pretty stone-faced.
All right. Well, that's a great underplayed story. You know, I actually wonder about the idea of, couldn't Tesla find somebody to open a dealership for them? And
well,
I don't know.
They just, that's not their business model. They don't want to do it. The dealers say that it's in the customer's interest to have the independent dealer because he can go to bat for you against the company. And I've actually experienced that. I've had a dealer push the manufacturer into honoring a warranty. So it does happen. Okay. But the idea that by law, this is the only way you can do it. You know, this is supposedly a free market state. Well, not there.
Okay. That's George Pyle's underplayed story of the week. For mine, I'm going to go with the potential for flooding in northern Utah. This is a story in the Tribune yesterday morning. And it's looking at the fact that if we don't have drought, then maybe we're going to have flooding. And it's the amount of snowpack and how quickly that could melt. Be prepared, everybody. That is my pick for underplayed story of the week. You can check it out at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, Tom Harvey, Emma Penrod, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis and Emily Means here at KCPW. Also to Tom Williams, Connor Rivers, and Krista Black at Utah Public Radio in Logan. And thanks to you for tuning in as well. Listeners, you can find podcasts of this program at our website, kcpw.org, or however you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Facebook. We are at KCPW-FM, and on Twitter, we are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great weekend.
My name is Risa Ledbetter, and I'm a reporter for Utah Public Radio. I might be considered a nerd, but I love bringing you stories about some of the most exciting science happening in Utah. If you have comments, story ideas, or questions, I'd love to hear them. Please visit our website at upr.org or call us at 1-800-826-1495. You can also share ideas on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just be sure to include the hashtag IAmUPR. Thanks for listening.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio. Heard statewide on KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, and KUSU-FM, Logan.